I've been told by Lisa that I have a few minutes to speak. Unusual, because ordinarily when I'm speaking, there are lights on the lectern. And when the red light goes on, you're supposed to sit down. But tonight, I want to talk to you, this audience particularly, about how did MTA have an influence on important events in my life. And ordinarily, in America, schools are told that they should teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. When I thought about what MTA meant in terms of experiences in my life, I think of Rashi, rhyme, and third, Rashi, rhyme, and let me think of that third one. Rashi, rhyme, and Rosh, of course, Rosh. Three R's. How Rashi? In MTA, of course, I learned, as I had in elementary school before, how to read Rashi. How did that affect any experiences in my life? Well, many years later, when I was the president of the International Association of Jewish Lawyers and Jurists, we had an event at the Supreme Court honoring the second of three Jewish justices who are now in the court, Stephen Breyer. And I asked Stephen Breyer what his Hebrew name was, because the year before we had honored Ruth Ginsburg, and her name being Rus, we had given her a volume of Rus, and we'd given her an engraving of a scene from Megillas Rus. So I wanted to know what Stephen Breyer's Hebrew name was. Was it Shimshon? Was it Shmuel? Well, when I asked Stephen Breyer, he did not know. Stephen Breyer, you have to know, is married to a woman who's not Jewish and never had a Jewish education. I went off to Israel and asked him to please fax to me what his Hebrew name was. And I got a fax in which he told me not only his Hebrew name, but his father's Hebrew name. He had learned these from his brother, who had a little bit more in the way of Jewish education. And what was it? It was Shlomo ben Yitzchak. Now, my MTA education, of course, taught me that Shlomo ben Yitzchak was Rashi. So I went out in Yerushalayim and looked for a lithograph that would have Ksav Rashi on it. In fact, I found a beautiful lithograph, and we had an event at the Supreme Court at which Justice Breyer was present. And I had the lithograph framed, beautiful writing of Ksav Rashi on the Ahavta, the first section of Kriyat Shema. Marvelous colors, beautiful lithograph. I unfurled it, explained that Rashi was the great Jewish commentator. And as a matter of fact, I could even look up how often Breyer, who had been a judge before, had used the word commentator or comment in his opinions. And then I said, the presentation should be made by someone other than me. And I invited for that event another graduate of Talmudical Academy, of Brooklyn, TA, a little-known professor by the name of Alan Dershowitz. And I said, the presentation will be made by this professor who hides off in the stacks. His name is Alan Dershowitz. Dershowitz had agreed to come for that event. And I said, Alan Dershowitz thinks, and Stephen Breyer thinks, that maybe Alan Dershowitz was invited to make this presentation because they both clerked for Justice Goldberg. That wasn't the reason. They may think the reason that Alan Dershowitz is making this presentation is because they both teach at the Harvard Law School. That was not the reason. I said, the real reason I asked Alan Dershowitz to make the presentation is because Alan Dershowitz was a student at Brooklyn TA in my father-in-law's shir. And I'd like Alan to please come up and read the Rashi. Alan came up. He said, we'll leave the Rashi for later, he said. But nonetheless, the presentation was made to Justice Breyer. But that isn't the end of the Rashi story, because a few years later, Justice Breyer said to me, Nat, do you know I was in London last week, and I went to the Marble Arch Synagogue. And at the Marble Arch Synagogue, the man came over to me when they were reading the Torah, and he said, he recognized me, and he said, Justice Breyer, what is your Hebrew name? We'd like to call you up to the Torah. And I, said Justice Breyer, first said to him, I really don't know. But then as he walked away, I said to him, 1 minute, come back. My name is Rashi. And would you believe it? I got called up to the Torah. That's how Rashi influenced one aspect in my professional career. Now, what about the second, the question of rhyme? In MTA, as you saw in the video, you get a terrific secular education. I learned English literature. I learned wonderful poetry. I learned to appreciate rhyme, sonnets, all kinds of poetry. Did that do me any good? Well, I'll tell you. When I had a case for Chabad over the Atlanta menorah, Chabad wanted to put up a menorah and had put up a menorah in Atlanta, Georgia for many years on the grounds of the state capitol. And along came the ACLU, who makes it a business to oppose menorahs, and they said, you can't put up a menorah on the grounds of the state capitol. It violates a regulation. Well, we looked at the regulation, and the ACLU was right. You couldn't put up a permanent display on the grounds of the state menorah, grounds of the state capitol. But then we looked at the regulation, and you could put up a display inside the rotunda of the state capitol. We said, we're going to put up the menorah there. They said, you're crazy. You can't do it on the grounds. You can't do it in the rotunda of the capitol. We said, oh, yes, we can. We're going to bring a lawsuit about it. Well, this was a series of lawsuits that we had brought for Chabad. A couple of years before, I had brought a lawsuit for Chabad in Grand Rapids, and the question was whether you could have a menorah without a Christmas tree. The Supreme Court case we won was one where a menorah was next to a Christmas tree. Could you have a menorah with no Christmas tree? Well, in that case, I ended up arguing before 15 judges of the Court of Appeals, the largest court I've ever argued before. We won 9-6. But while I was waiting to argue that case and thinking about what the ACLU was arguing, I wrote, with my MTA background, a limerick about what the ACLU legal theory was. And when I stood up before these 15 judges, I had 20 minutes to argue the case. When I was into my 55th minute, the chief judge said, Mr. Lewin, that's a terrific argument, but you're going to have to wrap it up. So, in violation of the rule that I tell my students, I decided I'd be funny. And I read the limerick to the court, hoping that that court would, if we won the case, put the limerick in the opinion. The court did not do that. We won 9-6, but I was very disappointed not to see my limerick. But then 2 years later, we had this case in Atlanta. And that, I argued before 11 judges. That argument went so swimmingly, and the chief judge was so congratulatory, that I thought, I've got to trot out the limerick. and I trotted out the limerick. And I will tell you, one of my proud accomplishments as a graduate of MTA is that I may be the only lawyer whose limerick has appeared in the federal reports. And the limerick, which is at 5 Fed 3rd, 1394 for the lawyers, the court says, with great panache, that's not a Jewish word, a Yiddish word, Chabad's counsel recited the following limerick to summarize his opponent's position. There once was a rabbi of Chabad who thought that the Constitution was odd. To allow all speech in a public place on AIDS or abortion or race, but to prohibit anyone from mentioning God. That's what the ACLU thought, but the courts have told them that they're wrong. Finally, Roche. I went to an elementary school, a yeshiva school, but in those days the rule was you didn't wear your yarmulke in the street. The school said if you walked out in the street, you had to take off your yarmulke because a skull cap was not to be worn in the street. I went to MTA and I learned differently. You wear a yarmulke in the street. And the question for me as a lawyer at one point was whether an Air Force psychologist was entitled to wear a yarmulke together with his Air Force uniform. We litigated that. Long story about our litigation. We ended up before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that there was no constitutional right to wear a yarmulke. But that's not the end of the story. The Supreme Court may have the last word on the Constitution, but it doesn't have the last word on what you can do in real life. So we went out to try to get a law that would require the military to wear a yarmulke, allow you to wear a yarmulke. Supporting us was a dissenting opinion by the man who was then the only Catholic on the Supreme Court, Justice William J. Brennan of the state of New Jersey, a great liberal and a great supporter of religious freedom. He had written an opinion in which he said that he hoped that Congress would cure the fact that there was no constitutional right to wear a yarmulke. We had a very hard time in the Congress. The House passed the law, but the Senate was difficult. Senator Barry Goldwater said he was proud to be 1/8 Jewish, but not in the military. Senator Chick Hecht said he was 100% Jewish, but he didn't think he had a right to show it in the military. And then came an American military victory in Grenada. Anybody remember the war in Grenada? We won the war in Grenada. And a chaplain went down to Grenada, and what did he do? He made a yarmulke of camouflage material. We thought that was a terrific idea, and what we did is we duplicated it for distribution in the Senate. It looked something like this. It was distributed in the Senate, and the law passed. The congressman who supported it, Congressman Solars, wrote a letter to Justice Brennan saying, "Thank you, Justice Brennan, for your dissenting opinion. We passed a law that said you have a right to wear a yarmulke in the military." And as a P.S. to a letter that he sent me a copy of, he said, "I enclose a sample of a yarmulke that we distributed through Senator Lautenberg's office that persuaded the Senate to pass the law." Coincidentally, Justice Brennan invited me to come and have lunch with him because he was getting an honorary degree at Hebrew University. It was the one time in his life that he went to Israel. He prepared a fruit salad for me. I came, I had lunch with Justice Brennan. We talked about Israel. At the very end, Justice Brennan says to me, "Nat, you know that yarmulke case you argued? Do you know that Congress has passed a law that requires the military to allow the wearing of yarmulkes?" I said, the truth is, Justice Brennan, I was involved in drafting that law. He says, well, I got a letter from Congressman Solars about it, and in with the letter was a camouflage yarmulke. And, says Justice Brennan, would you believe it? I put the yarmulke on my head, and I forgot I was wearing it. I wore it the rest of the day in my office. Of course, it's our motto that the first Supreme Court justice to wear a yarmulke in his office is a Roman Catholic. He said, I went home, and I was home for 5 minutes. I walked out through my secretary's office. My law clerks, whom I checked with later, and they verified this, were there, and they saw me wearing a yarmulke, and they were embarrassed to ask me why. I said, I went home. I was home for 5 minutes. Finally, my wife said to me, Bill, what do you have on your head? And I said, I felt it was the yarmulke. It was very comfortable. I told Justice Brennan to take it with him to Israel. I think he did, because half a year later, Eliakim Rubinstein, who was retiring shortly as a member of the Supreme Court of Israel, but was then just a foreign office person when we first met and had heard the yarmulke case argued in the Supreme Court, said to me, I met Justice Brennan in Jerusalem. And I walked over to him and introduced myself. And he said, and I said to him, I wear my yarmulke everywhere, even in the military. And when I said that, Justice Brennan pulled out this very funny looking yarmulke, put it on his head, and he said, me too. Now, since then, I've been told, the military has now put out yarmulkes that officially you can get a military yarmulke. These are all different versions of military yarmulkes that have been distributed. So, before my time is up, let me tell you one more yarmulke story, because it comes in under Roche. I've argued in every court of appeals in the United States. The last court of appeals that I argued in was a court of appeals for the Eighth Circuit, headquartered in St. Louis. And I had a case in which I represented Chabad in a case in the Eighth Circuit. I looked up who the judges were going to be, and the first leading judge was Judge Theodore McMillian. Doesn't sound like a Jewish name. I checked on him. He was appointed by Jimmy Carter, home in St. Louis. When the case was going to be argued, all the judges of the court, the whole Eighth Circuit, was sitting in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the morning and the afternoon. Our case was scheduled for the afternoon. I came to see the judges in action, both in the morning, prepared for the afternoon. I walk into the courtroom where Judge McMillian is sitting, and I almost fell over. Not only was he an African American, which I had not realized, but he was wearing a yarmulke. I was shocked, didn't understand why he would be wearing a yarmulke, and as a matter of fact, I met a young lawyer who was out in the hall who I knew, and who was the son of another judge on the court, and said, look, I've got a case this afternoon in which I'm representing a Hasidic group, and Judge McMillian is sitting there wearing a yarmulke. Why? And he said, I don't know. My dad has wondered about that too. Well, we took off for lunch. Lubavitch offers a great lunch if you represent them. Whether they pay you well or not, they give you a great lunch. We had a terrific lunch. And the rabbis, Lubavitch said to me, do we have any Jews on our three judges? I said, I don't think so, but you have an African-American judge who wears a yarmulke. They said, oh, he must be a Muslim. I said, no, it's not a Muslim cap. It is a kippah srugah. I saw it. It looked like the kind of yarmulke you buy on Ben Yehuda Street. How could it be? We came back into court in the afternoon. I sat down at counsel table, my opponent at his. The court crier called the court to order. The court walked in. Judge McMillian led the other two judges, wearing his kippah serugah. I got up, I argued, my opponent argued, I argued in rebuttal. Ultimately, we won this case. McMillian and the other judges were very active. Case was over. At the end of the case, the chief judge, who was McMillian, said, "Thank you, Mr. Lewin. We'll take the case under advisement," which is usually what judges say. I'm stepping back from the rostrum as he says, and this appears in the court transcript, he says, "Maybe I had better say something," he says. "I wear this yarmulke," and he called it a yarmulke, "not for any religious reason," he says, "but there's an air conditioner up above that blows down on the top of my head, and I don't have as much hair as my colleagues do." So these are lessons I learned at MTA. I learned about Gilly Roche. I graduated in 1953, 64 years ago. So think about it. I'm here today to talk to you about it. Samach Dalit. Siyata Dishmaya. Thank you.